Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 30th of September. These are our main stories. Islamist fighters in Somalia have launched two attacks on foreign troops targeting an American training base and an Italian convoy. Volkswagen is facing a mass lawsuit from German car owners over the falsified diesel emission scandal. World leaders have been attending the funeral of the former French president, Jacques Chirac. Also in this podcast...
I just had a slight shortness of breath a few times, and I thought maybe it's the airport. I could be allergic to something.
A lucky survivor, but a new report from the British Heart Foundation has found that women in England and Wales are dying unnecessarily after a heart attack. Officials in Somalia say suspected jihadists have carried out two separate attacks, one on a US military training base, the other on an Italian convoy in the capital, Mogadishu. Somalia has military forces from several countries deployed there to counter the threat from the Islamist rebels. I spoke to our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper, and asked her for more on what had happened.
It's very significant that in a single day, al-Shabaab has managed to hit two foreign targets, one in the heart of the capital Mogadishu, and then perhaps more significantly, this American military training base in Baledogle, which is not too far from Mogadishu, highly protected. It's a base where elite Somali forces are trained by the US, and it's also used as a launch pad for American drones who've stepped up their attacks against al-Shabaab under the presidency of Donald Trump. And so it really is a pretty big deal that they've managed to do this. And the fact that, as al-Shabaab and residents of the areas have said, they blasted through the gates of this heavily fortified base with a suicide bomb and then sent its fighters inside. And fighting has been reported to have gone on for several hours, heavy explosions. The military says that the al-Shabaab has now been driven back, but al-Shabaab has said that it actually is still in the base and still fighting.
What does this tell us then about security in Somalia, where military units are deployed from several countries, as we've been saying, to try to deal with militant violence?
Yeah, what is pretty extraordinary is that al-Shabaab, which is not made up of many more than a few thousand, if that, fighters, it's been in existence now for 13 years, and there's this enormous contingent of African Union troops. Thousands and thousands of them from Ethiopia, Uganda, Burundi, Kenya. There are also these special foreign forces. Turkey has an enormous military base. Its biggest foreign military base is in Somalia. And despite all of this and a large, if poorly trained and fractured, Somali army, they simply cannot manage to defeat al-Shabaab. So it shows that this group has just got incredible tenacity and brilliant intelligence.
Our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper. The Saudi Crown Prince has given a stark warning about the future of the world's oil supplies if the international community doesn't come together to counter the threat from Iran. In an interview on the American television network CBS, Mohammed bin Salman said he would prefer a political solution because war between Saudi Arabia and Iran would ruin the global economy. The Crown Prince also denied that he ordered the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul a year ago. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, listened to the interview.
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman stopped short of admitting any personal role in last October's murder of Jamal Khashoggi, as many suspect him of. But in his interview with CBS News' 60 Minutes programme, the heir to the Saudi throne called it a heinous crime for which, as a leader, he took full responsibility. He promised that investigations would be carried out regardless of rank, despite the fact that the chief suspect, Saud al-Ghahtani, has not been charged.
When a crime is committed against a Saudi citizen by officials working for the Saudi government, as a leader I must take responsibility. This was a mistake, and I must take all actions to avoid such a thing in the future.
On the question of imprisoned women's rights protesters, MBS, as the Crown Prince is commonly called, vowed to personally look into allegations of torture. He reserved his strongest words, though, for Iran, calling the recent drone attacks on the Saudi oil industry, which Iran denies, stupidity. If the world did not take strong and firm action to deter Iran, he said, then oil supplies would be disrupted and oil prices would jump to what he called unimaginably high numbers.
Frank Gardner. Suspicion was first raised about Saudi involvement in the killing of Mr. Khashoggi when covert recordings of the murder emerged. Now members of a UN investigation team have told the BBC's Panorama programme of the horror and shock of listening to his final moments. Just a warning, some people may find the contents of this report by Jane Corbin disturbing.
I wish I could go home and take part, but the environment is not welcoming to me.
In October last year, Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He was hoping to collect divorce papers so he could marry his Turkish fiancée. But the journalist was never seen again.
We only know that Jamal Khashoggi was murdered and the brutal way in which it was done because the Saudi consulate was bugged by Turkish intelligence. The planning and the execution were all recorded.
You can hear them laughing. It's a sort of chilling business. They're waiting there, knowing that this man is going to come in and he's going to be murdered.
British barrister Baroness Helena Kennedy is one of the very few people who have listened to the audio recordings. She took detailed notes.
The horror of listening to somebody's voice and the fear in someone's voice makes a shiver go through your body.
Ms. Kennedy was invited to join a team headed by Agnes Callamar, the UN's special rapporteur for extrajudicial killing. Ms. Callamar led the investigation into Khashoggi's murder and negotiated access to the crucial tapes.
The intention, clearly, on the part of Turkey to give me access to those calls was to help me prove planning and premeditation. We entered a big room, meeting rooms with a large machine for listening to tape. In total, we listened to 45 minutes, which covered 2 days.
The recordings reveal the truth of what happened inside the consulate building.
He's asking, are you going to do that to me? Are you going to give me an injection? To which he's being said yes.
Helena Kennedy again.
And he says, am I being kidnapped? How could this happen in an embassy?
And now Agnes Callamar.
The sound that are heard after that point indicate that he is suffocated, probably with a plastic bag over his head.
Ms. Callamar's report for the UN Human Rights Council concluded that Jamal Khashoggi was the victim of a premeditated execution for which the state of Saudi Arabia is responsible.
There is no indication under international law that this crime could be qualified under any other ways but as a state killing.
The recordings also counter the Saudis' claim that Jamal Khashoggi's death was a rogue operation, with the tapes revealing the planning that took place in the days leading up to the murder. Ms. Kennedy explains.
There's no doubt in my mind this was a seriously, highly organised mission coming from the top. This was not some flaky, maverick operation. No, no.
The Saudi government declined to give an interview to Panorama, but said it condemned the abhorrent killing and it was committed to holding the perpetrators accountable. It said that the Crown Prince had absolutely nothing to do with what it called a heinous crime.
That report by Jane Corbin. A first-class action lawsuit is underway in Germany with more than 400,000 German owners of Volkswagen diesel vehicles arguing they're owed compensation after the scandal over falsified emissions tests. It comes after three current and former Volkswagen executives were charged with market manipulation in connection with the scandal last week. Our international business correspondent Theo Leggett told me more.
This goes back to what happened 4 years ago, almost to the day, in fact, when Volkswagen was charged with the US authorities with deliberately trying to subvert emissions testing procedures for diesel vehicles by installing specialised software known as a cheat device in its cars that enabled them to detect when testing was being carried out bring in the emission control systems during testing while turning them off when the cars were being used on the road. Now, the outcome of that scandal, it had huge repercussions. It's cost the company in the order of $33 billion already. What we're seeing here is hundreds of thousands of people who own Volkswagen cars saying that they basically bought them under false pretenses and saw their value fall, and they want compensation. There are similar cases going on in the UK, in other parts of the world. One thing we've seen with this scandal is that in the United States, people had their cars bought back by Volkswagen and were fully compensated. In Europe, that has not happened. So this is about consumers trying to get some kind of compensation.
And just how damaging has this all been for Volkswagen, and how can they repair it?
Well, the wider scandal has been damaging financially for Volkswagen in that it has cost a phenomenal amount of money, and as I said, in the order of $33 billion. In terms of the company itself, well, its sales are back up to roughly the levels they were back in 2014. In fact, they're higher. And as a consequence of all of this, Volkswagen also set out to reinvent itself and to become a major producer of electric cars. The first fruits of a big investment program in electric cars are just coming onto the market at the moment. A car called the ID3 was launched at the Frankfurt Motor Show a couple of weeks ago. And now we have the prospect that because of this scandal, Volkswagen may actually have stolen a march on its rivals and got into this market sooner than it otherwise would have done, which potentially it could profit from.
So going into electric cars was very much a clear strategy to move on from the diesel crisis.
Absolutely. This was the company reinventing itself. It realised that it had a huge public relations problem on its hands. It had seen the bottom drop out of the diesel market, which it had invested a lot of money in. So Volkswagen's management took a conscious decision to invest heavily in electric vehicles and to focus the business in that direction. And we're now seeing the fruits of that.
Theo Leggett. World leaders have gathered in Paris to join mourners in paying their final respects to the former French president Jacques Chirac. A series of private and national ceremonies are being held today as part of a national day of mourning for the former leader. Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson reports from the French capital.
The body of Jacques Chirac, his coffin draped in the French flag, was carried into Saint-Sulpice by eight of his former bodyguards. The crowds, both inside and outside the church, paying their last respects to a man who, for all his perceived flaws, held a special place in the national memory of France. Among those gathered inside were dozens of leaders, both past and present, including the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Flags flew at half-mast, and later today a minute's silence will be held across the country. Jacques Chirac earned the affection of many people here by his easy charm and his strong stance against the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. President Macron described him as someone who embodied a certain idea of France.
Lucy Williamson in Paris. A new report from the British Heart Foundation has found that women in England and Wales are dying unnecessarily after a heart attack. Experts say there are inequalities in diagnosis, treatment and aftercare, and the report warned of the myth that it only affects men. Analysts say this isn't just a British trend, but a worldwide problem that affects millions of women. Martha Carney spoke to Esther Stanhope, who was 45 when she became unwell.
The last thing you think of is, oh, I must be having a heart attack. And here's the myth. You don't really have a heart attack. And I know that women and men have very different experiences. My experience is I had a feeling over a number of weeks, over a six-week period. I'm quite a busy person. You know, I speak at conferences. I went to Amsterdam and then I had to go to New York to speak at an event. So I thought it was stress. And I just had a slight shortness of breath a few times. And I thought, maybe it's the airport. I could be allergic to something. And then I went to America I was okay. It was intermittent. I had a few feelings in my chest of just, you know, they say when you have a heart attack, it's like an elephant on your chest. I mean, mine wasn't even a kitten. You know, it was really not painful. I wouldn't even say it was pain. And I spoke there and I felt really fine. I didn't kind of break out in cold sweats or anything, but I did go to a CrossFit class in America with my sister-in-law. I broke out in a sweat and in that particular moment I thought, wow, I really feel faint. Oh my goodness, I better walk this off. God, I can't get my breath back. And I think I might collapse in a minute. I better just you know, breathe. So when I finally got back to the UK, and I didn't even go to the doctor in
America.
So
you actually went on a flight, you had all these symptoms, yeah.
And you can imagine, I got back to the UK and I called the GP and said, look, I've just come back from New York. You know, I've had a slight feeling in my left arm, but nothing, no pain. And I've had a shortness of breath. I think I need to see my GP. And she said, go straight to A&E. So I went straight to A&E, and within an hour they'd said, I think you better stay here. And they didn't say you've had a heart attack. They just said, oh, we're a bit concerned about the results we're getting from the ECG. And then I stayed in the hospital and I was like, why am I staying here? I mean, this is overly cautious. I think on day three, I said, what's it actually, you know, what am I being treated for? They said, well, we think you might need a stent. You know, it might be a blocked artery. And I said, well, what do you actually call? You know, what have I actually got? And she said, you know, you're being treated for a heart attack.
Martha Carney also spoke to Professor Nilesh Samani, a cardiologist and medical director for the British Heart Foundation. So what did he think of Esther's experience?
Her stories were not atypical at all. You know, we hear this sort of story all the time where people who have symptoms suggestive of coronary heart disease and might be moving towards a heart attack often ignore symptoms for a while.
And is this more typical of women than men?
I think it is to some extent, because often coronary heart disease and heart attacks are perceived as a male disease, and therefore there's a tendency both within patients or individuals as well as in the health service for the symptoms to be perhaps be ignored more than would be otherwise be the case.
Do you think that was true in your family, Esther, that you saw it more as a male problem than a female problem?
Well, yes, my father died of a heart attack at age 40 in 1977, and I think he did have symptoms that he ignored, according to my mum. And I have four brothers, so I didn't think I was the one at risk. In fact, in the hospital, every time a cardiologist or a specialist would come in, they'd look at me and say, oh, hi, you know, so where's the patient? Yeah. As if they're waiting for me to bring in an elderly man, you know, and I was like, I am the patient. Oh, are you? Because I'm 45, I've got young kids. I don't look as if I'm about to keel over, you know. So absolutely, I think that I didn't expect to be a heart attack victim.
And so how do you think, Nilesh Samani, patients, particularly women patients in these circumstances, can be encouraged to be more aware of what the symptoms might mean?
So what our research has shown is that there's things that each change of the journey of a heart attack. So it's about raising awareness amongst women. That's what we are doing in the campaign that we started today, to raise awareness. But it's also the fact that they are disadvantaged to some extent when they're present. So people, as Esther has just said, you know, often the symptoms are perhaps dismissed more than they should be. So therefore, they receive slightly less optimal care. And that goes on to sort of treatments and also the recovery phase, where often women don't take up cardiac rehabilitation afterwards. So there are little differences at each stage of the journey. And what we wanted to do is to improve all of those things to save, you know, the lives being needlessly lost.
Professor Nilesh Samani from the British Heart Foundation. For more information, go to www.bhf.org.uk. Also in the podcast,
police had been searching for him for years. They then deployed high-definition drones, which spotted a tiny little bit of metal roofing that he'd placed over the entrance to a cave.
A Chinese fugitive who's been on the run for 17 years has finally been caught and arrested. The authorities in Hong Kong have rejected an appeal by activist groups to be able to hold a major pro-democracy rally as China prepares to mark the 70th anniversary of communist rule on Tuesday. Officials say they've received credible intelligence that activists who are demanding more autonomy are planning a major escalation in violence after a weekend of clashes between Hong Kong police and protesters. Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell is in Hong Kong.
Police say they're expecting that the 70th anniversary of the Communist Party coming to power will be very, very dangerous in Hong Kong. During a news conference, officers said they'd gathered intelligence via social media sites that some demonstrators in the city were planning actions which the police described as more like terrorism. They said suggestions had been made to mark the occasion by setting fire to shops and train stations, adding calls for undercover officers found within the ranks of protesters to be killed. Permission for a legal rally has been denied by the authorities. However, many thousands are expected to march through the city anyway.
Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. Police in China have arrested a 63-year-old fugitive who had been on the run for 17 years by using drones to locate his remote cave hideout in Yunnan province. I spoke to our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, and asked her for more on the fugitive.
This man was named Song Jiang. He escaped from a Chinese prison camp in 2002. He'd been convicted of trafficking women and children. So he appeared to simply disappear. Police had been searching for him for years. They then acted on a tip-off that he was living in the mountains of Yunnan. These are very steep mountains, a very remote area, part of China. And they searched but couldn't find him. They then deployed high-definition drones, which spotted a tiny little bit of metal roofing that he'd placed over the entrance to a cave where he'd been living. Police then had to hike for days to get to that location the drones had spotted. When they found Mr. Song, he hadn't spoken to another human in years. And the police said that he found it very, very difficult to speak and to use words again.
I mean, in some ways, it sounds like finding a needle in a haystack, so to speak. How developed is this type of technology?
Well, it is like finding a needle in a haystack. Photos released by the police show a tiny little dot of blue, this metal roofing, in this vast mountain range. And yes, they say they used high-definition drones carrying high-definition cameras. And we know that the Chinese police have been using these types of drones more and more. In fact, just last week, a new drone was released, a new camera called a super camera in China. It's five times more powerful than the human eye. So it can scan a crowd of 10,000 faces and apparently register each one of them. So this technology is only becoming more powerful. And the Chinese government is using this case, this fugitive who was missing for 17 years and their ability to find him, as a way to sell this kind of technology, to say to the Chinese public, look, we're using this to go and get the bad guys and bring them back to prison. Although, of course, on the flip side, there are many concerns about how this technology might be used to keep the Communist Party in power.
Celia Hatton. Bangladesh says it's looking for alternative sources of onions after its top supplier, India, banned the export of the vegetable due to soaring domestic prices. Onion prices have more than doubled in Bangladesh in recent weeks. Ambarasan Etirajan reports.
Bangladesh has already imported two shiploads of onions from Turkey and Egypt and is talking with Myanmar for additional supplies. The government is trying to assure people that the country has sufficient stocks. Onions are considered an essential ingredient in South Asian cuisine. Bangladesh imported more than 500,000 tons last year from India, which is the world's second largest producer after China. The Indian government's decision to ban the export on Sunday came ahead of key state elections later this year. While the monsoon rains are blamed for the crop damage, some suspect that hoarders may also be responsible for the short supply.
Ambarasan Etirajan. An exotic fossil discovered in the west of Ireland will be unveiled for the first time at a public exhibition today. It was discovered in a wall by Galway-based chartered surveyor and geological enthusiast Brendan Aragon in 2017. Dan Damon asked him to explain more.
This snail, it's a giant snail for its day, quite a big snail, 6 inches in size, 150 millimeters. It's circular in shape. And it's known now as a crested snail. It's lying on the seafloor in a warm tropical sea.
And tell us about the discovery, because that's another amazing part of this story, is that it's been there for so long and nobody noticed.
Yes, I suppose you could call it the second discovery of this snail, because I was doing a job across the road. I came out to have a cup of tea when I spotted this thing on the wall. So when I saw it, that was maybe 30 years after the wall had been constructed. And whoever built the wall naturally came across this fossil. Apparently the stone must have been split in two and the fossil showed up. But also we had the counterpart of the fossil on a second stone. So the builder of the wall decided, well, I'm going to face these outwards to show them off. So you could say he was the first to discover this fossil after the 340 million years that it had lied in the rocks in County Galway.
He was a builder, so maybe had an excuse. But you're a chartered surveyor. How come you know so much about fossils?
I have an interest in geology from going way back. I suppose the first memory I have of anything to do with geology was when a teacher at school, when I was in primary school, fourth class roughly, put up a picture of a volcano on the blackboard. And I was mesmerized at that stage. So my interest in geology goes way back till then. And since then, I've been a very bad person to walk with. Because if you walk with a geologist, he's going to spend a lot of time picking up stones and looking at walls and that type of thing.
I'm going to have a go, Brendan, at saying what this is called. Phanerotinus cristatus. Is that close?
Perfectly pronounced, yes.
Oh, great. And what's going to happen today?
Today, the public launch is happening. So it's open to the public. It's at Tuam Library in County Galway. Tuam is known as the smallest city in the world, and the public launch will be there in the library.
The geological enthusiast, Brendan Aragon. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.